From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation from the archives with David Joss about his collection Glossolalia, New and Selected Stories, which was published in 2013 by Press 53. When I spoke with David Joss about his collection, Glossolalia, he had spent the morning trying to get two snakes out of his garage. Living in Arkansas, it seemed to me at the time that these could have been very dangerous snakes. And that actually does come up in our conversation, so you may hear that. We started the interview with David's reading an excerpt from his story, The Stars at Noon. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
It might be helpful for your listeners to know that some of the things that might sound like a quotation are actually thoughts.
Okay.
So with that, I'll go ahead and start. The Stars at Noon is the title. She had been sleeping, it seemed. Then she heard someone cough. Who is coughing, she thought. Then she realized it was herself. Silly old woman. Silly half-dead old woman. Then she noticed that she was sitting up. Why? She looked around the hospital room. The vaporizer breathing the menthol odor of death. The late afternoon light on the linoleum, like the outline of someone killed in a highway accident. Anastasia shivered. Why did she have to think such thoughts? This was no time to think like that. This was a time for joy. She lay back into herself, hugged the chill inside her. It wouldn't be long now. Now what was that? Nurses talking in the hallway? She raised her head from the pillow and strained to hear what they were saying. But she couldn't make out the words over the hiss of the vaporizer, so she lay back. Then it wasn't nurses talking. It was cicadas buzzing in the trees around her father's farm. She'd heard that ratcheting hum every August when she was growing up. Once, she and Tom collected the brittle, umber-colored husks left in the elms after the humming stopped. She stood under each tree holding one of her father's empty cigar boxes while Tom shinnied up and found the desiccated husks. At first, he crushed a lot of them. They were so fragile. Later, he learned how to cradle them in his palm. She had that cigar box full of them somewhere. Where? And who was this? The nurse's face hung before her like a question waiting to be answered. Sister Anastasia, are you awake? Why did nurses wear white, nuns black? You have a visitor, sister. Hovering beside her in the half-light, Sister Beatrice. The children are right. We do look like blackbirds. She watched Beatrice pull a white handkerchief out of her black sleeve and blow her nose. The old nun laughed, then coughed. She hugged her ribs until she stopped coughing. Was this how Tom had felt? Dry and ready to crumble? Sister Anastasia? It was that big-nosed nurse again. What do you want now? It's time for your afternoon chest rub, but I'll wait till you're through visiting. Whenever you're done, just buzz for me, okay? He would drop down from the tree with his hands full of husks. I'm dying, she said, but Tom was gone. Pardon me, a voice said. Did you say something, sister? Anastasia turned to the voice's face. It was Sister Beatrice. Then she laughed. A blackbird with wire-rimmed glasses. She had to tell the children. The children. She had almost forgotten the children. How they would suffer when they heard she was dead. She remembered how hard they had cried last spring when the touring company of the Black Hills Passion Play performed the crucifixion at their school. And she imagined them at her funeral, the boys bravely blinking, and the girls, their faces in their hands. What was she thinking of? How could she think such a thing? I am an old sinner, she whispered. Forgive me. For what? Beatrice asked. You've never done anything to hurt me. You know that. Anastasia looked at the young nun. She was about to explain, but the coughing started again. When it was over, Anastasia was sitting up. Beatrice helped her lie back. Are you all right? Beatrice worried. I need a priest, Anastasia said. She'd been asking for last rites for 2 days, but all she'd received were more pain pills. Call Father Switzer. please. Don't you talk like that, Beatrice scolded. Dr. Gertner says you'll be fine in a week or so. You're going to be under the weather a while, but what do you expect when you don't wear your shawl when you should? You can't say we didn't warn you, and time and again. Anastasia smiled at her stern look. No wonder her children ignored her when she disciplined them. No matter how hard she tried, she couldn't look angry, not with that baby face. Then Beatrice's chin began to quiver and the stern look dissolved. Taking out her handkerchief, she turned away. I'm sorry, sister, she said. I shouldn't cry. There's nothing to cry about. Then she began to cry even harder. She turned back to Anastasia. Oh, sister, I hate to see you so sick, she sobbed, and threw her arms around her. Beatrice's wide wimple blocked the last bit of light from the hospital window, and Anastasia felt the darkness settling around her. She had been waiting for it, and it had finally come. She breathed it in, felt it fill her hollow cheeks and lungs. But Beatrice rose, wiping her tears, and the light came back. I'm not supposed to tell you this, she said, but I will. We're planning a big birthday party for you when you get back. We're going to decorate the lunchroom with balloons and crepe paper and signs, and the kids are going to sing happy birthday, and then we're going to have cake and ice cream and play some games. Sister Rose is going to bake a huge cake, and I'm going to decorate it. I had the best idea ever. I'm going to spell out your name with candles. Can't you imagine how beautiful it'll look when all the candles are lit? If a candle was still burning after you tried to blow it out, that meant you had a secret boyfriend. And if the stem of your apple snapped on the third twist, that meant his name began with a C. A young man was once in love with me, Anastasia said. Or did she? Sister Beatrice did not seem to hear. I know I shouldn't have told you, Beatrice was saying. It was supposed to be a surprise and everything, but I just wanted you to know how much we care about you. She shouldn't be thinking about Carl now. She didn't want to spoil her death with thoughts of old boyfriends. She was a nun, not a housewife. But everyone else who knew her when she was young was dead. Tom was dead. Mother and father. Her friends. Everyone. Carl was the only one left who would remember what she was like when she was a little girl.
Thank you so much for reading that. It's such a wonderful story, and I found myself drawn so quickly into Anastasia's story, despite the fact that, you know, she's got such a different life experience. You know, she's a nun and she's elderly. She's starting to lose some of her mental faculties, and she's sick, but she's just so identifiable. I just felt for her so much.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to ask about the language of, you know, your stories in general, and you're a poet too. And I thought the best way to ask is to be specific. So I was going to reread a paragraph from what you just read.
Okay.
If I may. Then it wasn't nurses talking. It was cicadas buzzing in the trees around her father's farm. She'd heard that ratcheting hum every August when she was growing up. Once she and Tom collected the brittle umber-colored husks left in the elms. After the humming stopped, she stood under each tree holding one of their father's empty cigar boxes while Tom shinnied up and found the desiccated husks. At first he crushed a lot of them, they were so fragile. Later he learned how to cradle them in his palm. And I just was so struck reading that. You can actually take the word desiccated and reconfigure it to say cicada. You know, and you have cicadas and cigar box and desiccated husks.
I've got a lot of us sounds in there too. Umber and husks.
Yeah.
I think whether you're writing poetry or prose, you should be thinking about how the language sounds and how it fits. And I wanted to get both the hard sound of the ratcheting of the cicadas and also the humming sound of it. It's a real mixture of sounds. And so I had the hard K's and the soft U's in there.
Yeah.
An awful lot of writing is about vowels. A lot of people don't stop and think about it, but the vowels probably do more than anything to affect how we respond to something.
Really?
There's a reason why we say eek and yippee when we're either frightened or happy, and we say things like gloom and doom when things are miserable and dark. The vowels are arranged. I mean, you can think about them as being arranged on a scale from high to low.
Right.
And if you write an exciting scene with a lot of low vowels, you won't communicate what you're after. And vice versa, if you're writing about a dreary moment and you're full of high vowels, it's discordant.
And the vowels that you used, are they sort of hypnotic or dreamlike, would you say? Or
well, I tried to repeat especially the sound in there because I was trying to capture that humming.
Humming, right. Right, and then later the nurse says that she should buzz her. And, you know, it's like these are just little things that probably if you're just enjoying a story, you know, the average reader won't think about so much. Because I had already picked up on desiccated, I started looking around for all this stuff, and I was like, wow. It's so...
Well, I'm glad you noticed that. And by the way, I would like to hire you to do all my reading for me.
Thanks. Okay, so let's step back a minute. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how this collection, Glossolalia, came to be.
Okay. First of all, I started writing back in the early 70s, well, I guess 1970, fairly seriously. And after all these years, I decided I would try to publish a new and selected. And so I sat down and I looked at everything that I had written over the years, and I threw out immediately the things that didn't hold up to me at all. And for good or ill, I wound up with about 500 pages left.
Wow.
And it's like, you know, it's like if you have 12 kids or something, how do you decide which ones you're not going to let into the party?
Right.
So I actually did something that I would never recommend anyone to do. I sent all 500 pages out as the submission and just acknowledged that I knew it would have to be cut, but that I didn't feel up to it. Now then, if I were an editor, I would even read the first word after getting a cover letter like that. But I was lucky to have some editors who were actually willing to read through it.
Yeah.
And so essentially what happened was that the editor for Press 53, who's a wonderful, intelligent reader named Christine Norris, said that she would read through the collection and pick her favorites and then let me know and I could weigh in on it. And she came up with the list, and it I think I made one substitution is all.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of agreed on what should be in it, and there might be a second volume coming out if this one does well, which would contain the other half of the stories that I originally sent. One of them is a novella. It's about 90 pages long, and so that kind of prohibits being included in this first one because it shortens the number of things that can be used.
Has the novella been published in another place?
Yes. It was an early... all of the stories that are reprinted in Glossolalia from my first book have been strenuously revised.
Mm-hmm.
And the novella was included in that, and that has been very much revised as well. In fact, all of the stories that are in the book that have been previously published, even if they've only been published in magazines, have been revised for this collection. So it's kind of, me showing people this is what I've learned about how to write stories over the nearly 40 years I've been doing.
Yeah.
For better or worse, that's what the collection is. These are the best versions I've been able to make of those stories, and I was really pleased that I had the opportunity to go back to the earlier work and make it better. So
Was it fun, like all these years later, to sit down and look at that stuff again? You're saying it was a pleasant task, but
yeah,
I'm just wondering, was it frustrating to see things that you wished hadn't gone out that way originally?
No, I wished it hadn't gone out that way back when it was initially published.
Mm.
People often think that publication is going to make them happy. It usually makes you miserable. Yeah. When it comes out, you think, oh, gosh, I should have done this, I should have done that. And over the years, I had revised all of those stories and all of the stories in my second collection, although not nearly as much as the first one, and with the idea that eventually I would try to publish this new and selected. So I had them all revised and ready to go. So it was a process that covered many years. It wasn't something I did over a short period of time.
Yeah.
So it was both pleasant and painful. The painful part being knowing that people had read some of these earlier versions. Thank God, not that many.
I wanted to talk about the first story that shows up in the collection. It's called Torque. I love the story. I was happy to see it in here. I have read it before. And I'll just give a little tiny summary, and you can change or add to what I say if you think I've forgotten anything. So after returning from the service, the main character, Larry, dreams of owning a limousine, and he decides to build his own limousine by cutting a Cadillac in half. And as the story progresses, his life starts to sort of fall apart, and he falls gradually into a depression. Would you say that's a pretty accurate setup of the story?
Very accurate, yes.
Okay. So I don't want to give everything away that happens to him, but I wanted to ask you about the character Elizabeth, who she's a mentally disabled woman who lives across the street from the main character. And I remember reading this the first time, and again, this time I could not stop thinking about the relationship between these two characters. Elizabeth speaks nonsense, and yet the two of them seem to come to form a kind of bond, and part of that, I think, has to do, or I'm quite sure, has to do with Larry's changing state of mind. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the role that Elizabeth plays in the story and how her presence sort of gives us insight into Larry.
Well, that's a good question, and I wish I had a good answer for it. I can tell you this, that when I wrote this story, I was utterly shocked and surprised when Elizabeth showed up.
Oh.
I had no idea that she was going to show up there and become an important character in the story. But when she did, I went with it. I followed her and her role in it, and I began to see her in some ways as a foil to Larry's wife. In many ways, she's the opposite of his wife, and while the relationship with his wife is deteriorating, he finds someone that he can actually get to share his dream of the limousine.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that she's mentally challenged, also fits in with his own mental deterioration in the course of the story.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about Elizabeth and his wife and the different ways that they...
I didn't think about it until well into having work on the story.
Yeah.
Something that you just have to trust in the writing process. There's a reason why something comes to mind. Eudora Welty says that in early drafts there will be a little detail that she'll look at and wonder, why on earth did I include that? And then she thinks about it, and it becomes really at the heart of the revision of the story.
Mm-hmm.
We often tend to cut too quickly the things that don't seem to fit, and rather than ask the question, why did I think this thing that doesn't seem to fit? Is there some underlying thing I'm missing about my own story? I firmly believe that we're kind of collaborating with our unconscious minds when we're writing, so we're not aware of things, and we have to accept what comes up and try to decide whether it can be used or not.
Yeah, okay. That's really interesting. I have a question later that maybe we'll come back to some of this subject matter.
Okay.
Another story that's early in the collection is called Freeze, and it takes place in Vietnam during the war.
Mm-hmm.
The main character is Freeze, who's a private in I'm assuming the Army.
Army, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he survived stepping on a mine because it didn't go off. So I have a specific question about something that you do in this story. And once again, if you don't mind, I'll read a little bit.
That's great.
Hold on, here we go. Freeze stood there, breathing hate, and stared at Reynolds, an animal snarl on his face. He hated him more than he'd ever hated the NVA. He hated him more than the heat and the jungle, the leeches and mosquitoes, the monsoon rains, the smells of sulfur and death, more than his 60-pound pack, the blisters on his shoulders, the wet socks, the jungle rot and immersion foot, more than the lizards that cried, F you, F you, F you, in the night, the thump of mortars, the booby traps, more even than the mine that hadn't gone off. And I did have to change that FU for the radio, but I thought it was wonderful in the story, the way that works.
Yeah, those insects actually were known in Vietnam as FU insects.
That's so funny.
That was the name, because that's what they sounded like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just could hear it as soon as I read that.
Mm-hmm.
The paragraph starts out feeling like it's about his hatred for Reynolds, and it is about his hatred for Reynolds, but it is also this incredible way to convey to the reader all of the daily horrors that they are going through and filling in this world for the reader, but it, you know, not through straight description, so it's just more interesting. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, what I wanted to do there was just sort of pile all into one sentence everything that has been miserable in his life since going to Vietnam, and how I sense that how he's funneling all of that into Reynolds. Certainly not without some good reason, but also irrationally. There's no Reynolds doesn't deserve that amount of hate.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to just convey how all of that has built up, and he has transferred what he can't affect elsewhere onto this one person he thinks he can, you know, relieve his hate on.
And it's interesting because at the beginning of the paragraph, it's Reynolds that we're focused on, and at the end, it's that mine that didn't go off. And I don't remember, to be honest with you, if this is the first time in the story that we have a sense that he's at all conflicted about whether or not that mine should have gone off, you know. But it's just an interesting, I don't know, this paragraph has an interesting movement, I thought. So
yeah, everything changes when he steps on the mine and doesn't go off.
Mm-hmm.
See, it turns him into a joke to some of his fellow soldiers. They start calling him Freeze because that's what he did at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, yeah. And like you say, part of it is there's some conflict. In some ways, he feels he'd be better off if it had gone off.
Yeah. Let's see. Okay, I'm going to step away from glossolalia for just a minute. You write for the Writer's Chronicle, which is the magazine that comes out of the Associated Writing Programs. And I love reading your essays about writing. And your essays or your articles are always, you know, they cover a lot of material. And I don't mean for us to go into all of the material of this article, but I enjoyed reading Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Abstraction, Modes of Conveying Emotion. And I wondered if we could just talk a little bit about abstraction in prose.
Sure.
Early on in the article, you provide three sentences of abstract emotion, and they are, Jason was delighted, Trisha's anxiety rose, and there was anger in Evan's voice. And then later you offer some that seem less abstract, but in fact they're still really abstract. So somebody was visibly upset, or, you know, Timmy was obviously pleased. But there's still abstraction. So I wonder, can we just talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, well, I want to make it clear that I'm not proposing or supporting saying obviously pleased or anything like that.
Right.
I was pointing out that essentially those are what I would call sensory bypasses.
Mm-hmm.
How was so-and-so obviously pleased? How was it obvious? The author doesn't tell us. So-and-so was visibly moved. Well, maybe to the narrator, but not to the reader. The reader hasn't seen what that narrator said. The word seemed is one that shows up a lot. He seemed unhappy. Well, what about him seemed unhappy? I want people to go beyond that little bypass of the actual experience that the character is having to the abstraction. But I also acknowledge in the article that there are times when abstractions can work, particularly when they're coupled with metaphor or body language or physical sensation, or if they're complex enough. I can't remember the exact phrase, but I think it's from a Laurie Moore story. It's been a while since I wrote this essay.
Yeah, it's a couple years old.
About peaceful depression or something of that sort. Well, those are two abstract words, but their juxtaposition is surprising, and it makes us think about that emotion in a way that we wouldn't otherwise have thought of. Sometimes you can actually get something with with an abstraction that you can't otherwise, but it's going to require some twist of what we expect. And there's also, I think, a quote from Frederick Exley, who talks about rage as being like a cocoon, if I remember right. So we have something that's negative described in terms of something we tend to think of as comfortable and supporting, and it lets us know that that character is actually getting some comfort out of being in a state of rage. And that points to an emotion that'd be pretty hard to capture otherwise.
Yeah. Now, I find sometimes that I slip into abstraction along the lines of Trish was visibly upset when I'm trying to maintain the point of view. You know, Trish was upset might start to sound like a statement from Trish's point of view, but if we're in somebody else's head and he or she is watching Trish, so that word, mm-hmm. you know, doesn't interrupt the perspective, but I'm guessing that's sort of a trap and you have to be careful.
I can see what you're talking about, but even though the person is recognizing that, we're not getting the experience that the point of view character is getting. Mm-hmm. The point of view character sees that other person and then thinks the thought upset. If you really want to put us in the character's experience, you have to not only tell us the narrator's conclusions, but also the narrator's experience that led to those conclusions. So I'm adamantly opposed to the visibly upset. seemed upset, you know, all those kinds of things that just skirt around the actual presentation of the experience. I think that ultimately fiction is the translation of ideas and feelings and emotions, all those things, into experience for the reader. And the more we interpret or explain that experience, the less the reader can actually share it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm always for trying to get down into what the character's feeling at that moment. Like in that sentence you read about Freeze, at that moment everything that he hates about his life is coming to bear on him. And that's why we get the list of all those sensory details about life in Vietnam during the war.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to ask, does form ever precede an idea for you? For example, Apotheosis is a story in this collection that's in an epistolary form. Deliverance is another story in this collection, and it's sort of in the form of an interview. And I just wondered, in each of those cases, which came first, the character and idea of the story or the form?
Form has never come first. In fact, it's interesting you mentioned Deliverance because that form is not used in the original version.
Oh, interesting.
Basically, she's just talking in the original version. There's no back and forth between him and the court-appointed psychologist that's
okay.
interviewing her.
Okay.
So the form came about entirely in the last revision of the story. As far as Apotheosis goes, originally it was even more complex formally than it is now. It had an extra layer around it. Right now it has a very brief introductory note from an editor, you know, an unnamed anonymous editor.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get the frame letter from a Spanish priest, and then we get the account that he read, which comes from a priest in... it would be Guatemala, but it was New Spain at that time. And so we got a little frame story, but just that one little note by the editor. In the original version, the editor is constantly interrupting with footnotes, most of which are kind of obsequious and stupid, and basically revealing that he's missing the whole point of all of the story. I was clearly influenced by Vladimir Nabokov's Pale Fire, which uses that same kind of an external editor. But I realized when I rewrote the story that none of that helped. It all detracted from the story, so I cut that extra layer of the frame. So instead of now having the editor really continuing throughout and commenting again at the very end, it's actually simpler in its form now than it was then. But when I did start it, I knew it was going to be a frame story in the sense that it was going to have the Spanish priest and also the one from New Spain telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
It was my way to get at the history of the Inquisition, which I had only learned about as an adult. I was raised Catholic, and somehow the subject never came up in my classes. So I was surprised to learn some of these things, and so the story is kind of dealing with some of the sorts of things that happened during the Inquisition, which lasted for about 400 years.
Yeah. I thought it was a fascinating story, and it was such a departure from, I think, most of the material that I read in contemporary fiction. You know, you don't really see people writing stories about these. I mean, I don't know. I'm generalizing,
yeah.
But.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually the oldest story in the book. I think it came out in 1976 or 77, something like that.
Huh.
And when I was first writing, I tried so many different kinds of stories, and I still do vary quite a bit, but not nearly as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
So organizing and putting together this new and selected was complicated because there were stories written, like 30-some years ago, next to some written very recently, and they might have some similar concerns, but they're very different styles. I've got one story in there that's that sort of takes off from Chekhov's famous story, Misery.
I know, I loved it.
It's set in 19th century Russia, and it actually borrows passages from Chekhov's story and takes one of the minor characters of that story and makes it the main character of this one. So there's some more. It's not a really cohesive collection in the sense of style. It jumps around, but that's part of that's always been part of my aesthetic. I'm interested in writing from other characters' perspectives and other times and other sensibilities.
Yeah, yeah. You just mentioned the story Misery, which I wanted to talk about too. And the annotation after this the title Misery is after Chekhov. So first of all, did you edit it a lot for this collection?
I don't think it's too much changed. No,
no.
I mean, it has changed. But,
okay, yeah. I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I so loved that story, and I know that Chekhov is pretty much your literary hero, and one question I had after I read it was, how did you feel about the story when it first appeared in print? Were you at all hesitant to try to put this out in the world, or was it tempting to just keep it as your own because he was your hero?
No, I didn't really have any qualms about it at all. I think writers have always been in conversation with each other.
Yeah.
Chekhov's story, The Darling, is his response to Flaubert's A Simple Heart. Joyce Carol Oates, a few years ago, published a story called Lady with a Pet Dog. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
Brett Lott has a story which takes off from Faulkner's A Rose for Emily. I can't remember the title. I think it might just be Rose, but... It's a long tradition that writers have of responding to other writers' work, and so I didn't really feel like it was that audacious a thing to do.
No, not audacious, just a little intimidating. I don't know.
Oh, of course it's intimidating. I'm trying to write a Chekhov story, for God's sake. But that was, that's always part of the fun. The fun of writing is trying to do something that you know you can't do.
Yeah.
Everything about writing is impossible. We're trying with little black marks on the page to create human beings and in a world and meaning, and that's not an easy task. And then if you try to do it in this style and context of one of the greatest writers who ever lived, then that's even more intimidating.
Yeah.
But it's also part of what's fun.
Yeah. How important to you are character names?
They're very important. John Gardner has a comment in one of his books that if you change the name of a character, the whole fictional ground underneath him shifts.
Okay.
When I first was in graduate school at Syracuse, my teacher was George P. Eliot, a really marvelous writer who unfortunately is a little bit too forgotten right now. And George had a novel called Muriel, and he told me that he had been working on it for years and not getting anywhere. And at that time, the character's name was Miriam. And he changed it to Muriel, and he said, and everything clicked. Yeah, and that may sound utterly bizarre to a non-writer, but it is extraordinarily true. It's really, really odd how the sound of the name, the rhythm of the name, your associations with that name, all of that is essential. So you can't just go in and change a character's name without changing the character. We also have to remember that the name functions in a story the same way a physical body functions in life. When we say, Joe came in the room, what we're reading is the word Joe, but in reality, we would see Joe's body come into the room. Mm-hmm. So the name really has to stand for someone and become so strongly connected with that person that every time the name appears, we have the sense of that character's physical presence. So the names are very important to me.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting to me. I'm working on something right now, and I just feel like the name is wrong. And actually, something you said earlier struck me and occurs to me now again, and that is the vowels. You know, a name will carry vowels just like any word does.
Mm-hmm.
And you
sure.
know, from was it Marion to Muriel? Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just, I don't know, it does. It feels like they're going to be different sensibilities that are brought.
He said, just changing the name, it occurred to him one day, no, this is not the right name. It should be Muriel. And he said that from that moment on, she was there on the page for him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an almost mystical kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little exercise people used to do. They would draw sort of a glob of, circular kind of glob on the board, and then draw kind of something like a lightning bolt strike. And then we would say, which one is named Una and which one is Zik? And everybody immediately knows which one is Una and which one is Zik, and it's entirely through vowels and consonant sounds.
Yeah.
So we make those associations. So when we say Una, whether we, have described the character or not, we're not seeing something that looks like Zik.
Yeah. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about the story Constellations.
Okay.
And in this story, a woman leaves her baby on a bus in her sort of crazed and literally mindless effort to flee the scene of a shooting. She and her baby on her bus, and right near them, somebody fires a gun at somebody else. And she literally just, in a thoughtless moment, manages to get off the bus by herself, and the baby is left on the bus. One mm-hmm. aspect of this story that I loved was that after she leaves the scene, she's the only one who knows what she's done. In somebody else's story, maybe it would be on the evening news, and that would be the storyline, or the driver would track her down and confront her husband with it. But that's not a David Joss story. In your story, she has to deal with it on her own, and she knows, what she did. And I love that, and I feel like it complicates things for her and makes it a more interesting story for us.
I'm more interested in guilt than I am in humiliation. Humiliation is an easy thing to do, but she feels guilt whether anybody knows it or not. There is one moment when I think it's the bus driver brings the baby to her, and she knows that guy knows that he left her.
Yes,
but that the sense of humiliation is not really what bothers her. It's the sense that in that moment she chose preserving her own life to protecting her daughter. Now, I read this story once, a couple of women came up afterwards and said that they found it totally implausible that no mother would leave their child. And I found that response almost funny because, you know, that's what we would like to believe. But I started this story because of an actual incident that occurred on a bus in Louisiana. It wasn't anything like what I described in the story, but a woman had abandoned her child when a fight broke out on a bus. Well, I made it even worse. I made it a shooting. Mm-hmm. And right here in Little Rock, about a month after I'd started the story, there was an incident of road rage where a man got very angry at a woman who was driving and chased her, and she finally pulled the car off to the side of the road and ran off into a farmer's field right outside of Little Rock, leaving her infant strapped into a car seat in the back. And what I was interested in is, how does somebody live with that moment? Mm-hmm. I remember something that Andre Debuse said after his terrible accident. Your listeners may know the story, but briefly, Andre stopped on a highway in Massachusetts to help some accident victims, and then a drunk driver came and was heading right toward him and a woman and her brother. Andre shoved the woman out of the way, the man got out of the way, and Andre was the one who was hit. Mm-hmm. He wrote me a letter sometime after that in which he said there was one good thing that came out of this. He lost one leg and essentially the use of the other. The one good thing that came out of it, he said, is now that he knew that in a moment like that, he would make the right choice and try to protect someone.
Yeah.
The thing is, we don't know until we're put in a position like that which choice we would make. We'd like to think we'd all be the heroes, but I think relatively few people would be.
Right, right. And the fact that Angela, in your story, is confronting her guilt over what she's done. I wanted to mention the way the story opens. The story opens with a sort of if-then sentence. Mm-hmm. And later, as I was reading, I looked back and I thought that was the perfect way to start this story, because even that is a sentence that kind of tries to justify her. Here's the sentence. If Marley hadn't gotten sick, Angela wouldn't have been on the bus that morning. Was that the sentence you started with, or did you come to that sentence later?
Oh, I came to it much later, after I understood what the story was about.
Okay.
This often happens. You have to go back and rewrite your opening once you discover what your story is actually about. It's about all the chains of circumstances that can lead up to an event. And when we're feeling guilt, we're frequently trying to find, well, you know, if I had done that instead, I never would have been put in this situation. So it's you know, fate more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a late addition.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I was going to say about this story is it actually has a couple of storylines going on. The more sort of noticeable one is, of course, this experience on the bus. But there's also a backstory about Angela's marriage and her husband having had an affair. And both of these storylines sort of deal with issues of trust and errors that were made.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way they braid together, you know, her thoughts about her husband's infidelity and her thoughts about her own mistake. You never really kind of stand them up right next to each other, but
right.
they're there together. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about braiding plots that complement and sort of enrich one another.
Sure. Grace Paley always said that you had to have two stories to write one story.
Okay.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that. If there hadn't been that other story about the husband, I think the story would have been fairly thin. Because part of what happens when she does this thing that she can't forgive herself for is that it helps her forgive her husband. When we recognize our own guilt, it's easier to forgive other people. And so I think that's partly what's going on in the story, that it gets the surface story gets some of its meaning from the subterranean story.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I've often thought of Grace's comment about you need two stories to write one.
Yeah, I remember Nance Van Winkle once saying that she likes to have, I think the way she put it was, she likes to be juggling three balls in the air. So yeah. she goes even one step further, I guess.
Yeah, if you've got three stories, that's even better. You have more to braid.
Do you ever get any flack for having imitated accents in your stories? For example, the accent of a visiting ball player from Santo Domingo or the accent of a Hmong immigrant?
Yeah, I do get flack. And in fact, I sent the Sacred Drum, which is a story from the Hmong refugees' point of view, I sent that to a magazine, and I got a letter back, a rejection letter, saying our editors were offended by your colonialist appropriation of another culture.
Mm.
You know, and that is a very common attitude these days. That I mean, if we follow the arguments that a lot of people make to their logical end, it means that we can only write about things that are related to our own experience. Well,
right.
I was drawn to writing and reading for precisely the opposite reason. I'm curious about other people. I'm not curious about my own life. I would not have a particularly exciting life to write about. It's see Dave sit in a chair and read, see Dave sit at a desk and type. You know, it's not a particularly exciting life.
I don't know. You've got snakes in your garage.
I have snakes in my garage. That's the excitement for the day. But it's not, I can see it now as a movie, Snakes in the Garage, starring Samuel L. Jackson. But anyway, I'm interested in other people, and I think you have to be able to capture the rhythms of their speech and so forth. And I think it's actually wrong of us not to try to think and feel from perspectives that are very different from our own. So I have a Dominican ball player, and I can tell you a nice little story about how people reacted to that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, it started with watching a baseball Hall of Fame ceremony, and Juan Marichal, who is from the Dominican Republic and had been in America for 25 years or whatever, gave his speech, and I absolutely loved the way he broke the language.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like poetry to me. And so while he was speaking, I think this actually was not a live thing, but a tape thing I saw on television from years before, I wrote down some of the things that he was doing and some of the words he used. And I imagined a character in a minor league team, and we have one right here in Little Rock that I used to go watch fairly regularly, and I imagine one of those players being from the Dominican Republic, and started to spin the story that way, basically just to use that language, and discovered the story as I went. Well, after it was published, I got a letter from Julia Alvarez, who is, of course, from the Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote a very kind letter telling me how much she liked it, and that she pointed out only two errors that I had made in the dialect. And I've made those corrections in every version that's been published since, including Glacialia. I had the phrase depend on, and she said, for some reason, Dominicans say depend of.
Yeah, because in Spanish, that would be the direct translation.
Yeah, and instead of saying psychiatrist, they would say curandera, which is essentially like a witch doctor or something.
Uh-huh.
And so I put those two changes in. But that reaction meant a great deal to me, because this was someone who knew the language, knew how Dominicans in America spoke, and didn't really have any significant problem with it and liked the story. There are some people that automatically assume that because I'm not Dominican, I don't have the right to try to imagine my way into a Dominican character. And I would just say to them what those insects say in Vietnam.
I want to talk a little bit about the title story, Glacialia,
okay.
Which is such a wonderful, wonderful story. The main character, yeah. The main character, Danny, witnesses his father having what used to be called a nervous breakdown. And I was just really struck, and I mean, I love the story in a lot of different ways, but what really struck me personally reading this story was that it took me right back to how it feels to be a child or a teenager, not yet of age, sort of always shunted to the outskirts of anything that happens in a family, anything large or dramatic, you know. So Danny is the one who witnesses this, but as soon as his mother comes home and a doctor is called, Danny is pushed aside, and he can only observe what he can. And again, I'm going to read a little paragraph here. My mother ran to the door and opened it, and I heard her say, "Thank you for coming so quickly. He's in the kitchen." As they hurried down the hall past the living room, I caught a glimpse of Dr. Lewis and his black leather bag. It had been years since the doctors in our town, small as it was, made house calls, so I knew now that my father's problem was something truly serious. You know, that really reminded me of what it's like to be a kid, and you watch and you kind of interpret what you can see, but you're not allowed to see everything, and you only hear little bits and pieces. And that was really very well done. I really enjoyed that.
Well, thank you.
I wondered, too, if you can talk a little bit about trying to infuse a narrative with some sort of, I'm going to call that a universal truth, something that readers can relate to from their own experience, from their own lives, and they bring a sense of empathy to a story that's not their own.
Yeah, I think virtually everybody can empathize with everything because we've all felt all the emotions, and we just have to create a situation that the reader can't help but identify with the character, even if that character is behaving in a way that we wouldn't approve of. People frequently talk about whether a character is likable or sympathetic or not, and that's an issue that seems to me to be a waste of time. Some of the great characters in literature are not likable, but they're fascinating nonetheless, and we can still identify with them. And how many people would want to hang out with Ahab? You know, you know, want to go on a weekend trip to the Hamptons with Iago? But these characters fascinate us nonetheless, and so I think the focus on having a likable, sympathetic character, someone that someone can easily identify with, is mistaken. And what we want is to have characters that we can identify with, but at the same time, we kind of cringe. Danny is, I think, a sympathetic enough character. We know what it feels like to be an adolescent shunted aside. We know what it's like to have conflicting feelings about our parents and so forth. But he also does some things that I would think people would feel weren't the right choices and would make them embarrassed to feel that they're being sympathetic to the character at that moment. And that's, to me, what writing is about, getting us as readers to face our own culpability in all of these things.
Right. You know, we would leave the baby on the bus, maybe.
We would leave the baby on the bus, yeah. But also, it's not like a detective story where, the evil is out there, all the bad things are out there, and we're identifying with the person who's guiltless. And eventually the guilty party is arrested and order is restored to the world. No, we're the guilty party. That's the more interesting story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I never knew the word glossolalia, I'm embarrassed to say, until I read this. And and actually, the first time I read this story, I didn't look it up. But this time I did, and it's another word for speaking in tongues, which I never knew.
Right.
And so like the first story in the collection, Torque, this last story, Glossolalia, involves, mental health and sadness and madness, but also a character who speaks in nonsensical words that confuse and worry people around him. And I loved the way these things come back full circle, and they kind of offer a sense of completion to the collection as a whole. You know, in Torque, we have Elizabeth speaking nonsense, and then here at the end, in Glossolalia, Danny's father, in his moment of nervous breakdown, does have a period where he's speaking nonsense. So I just I liked that coming back to at the end, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about sort of the the narrative arc that brings us, well, no, not narrative arc, the structural arc that brings us back to some of these ideas.
Well, I'm glad you had that reaction, because that's exactly why I put those two stories in the places that where they are. I want them to be kind of like bookends. And in a sense, in the first story, we're watching Larry go farther and farther into mental illness. In the final story, we're watching the father come out of it.
Oh, right. And thank you for that.
Yeah, so that was part of the strategy as well. It's a hard thing to arrange stories that were written over several decades in a meaningful way. And I feel a little bit embarrassed to say this, since I wrote an essay once about how to organize story collections.
Yeah.
But I have a heck of a time organizing this one.
I'm glad to hear that, actually.
Yeah, well, this was really tough. I didn't really have much trouble with my other collections, but since this covered such a wide territory and such very divergent stories, I had to find a way in which they, you know, sort of talk to each other, and you know, a story can gain something by rubbing shoulders with one next to it. And I tried a lot of different structures, but from the very start, I knew that Torque would be first and Glossolalia would be last.
Mm-hmm. And is that why you named the collection Glossolalia?
Yeah, also because as a writer, I speak in tongues.
Okay.
In the tongues of a Hmong refugee and a Russian dwarf and and a Dominican baseball player.
You know, right. And a nun with dementia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's kind of what writers are. We're speaking in different tongues, even if we have, say, a set style or voice. When our characters speak, they're, you know, we're speaking in their tongues as well.
Great. Well, this was wonderful. I really enjoyed speaking with you today. The book, again, is Glossolalia, New and Selected Stories by David Joss, published by Press 53. David, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a delight for me, too.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with David Joss. You can learn more about his work at his website, davidjoss.com. And you might be interested to know that from time to time, David has been teaching online workshops in conjunction with the publisher of Glossolalia, which is Press 53. His upcoming talk on Point of View is actually sold out, as I understand it. But I would say you couldn't go wrong watching to see if they offer it again, should you be so inclined. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about a man who is trying to get two dangerous snakes out of his garage. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I hope that you are staying well and feeling safe. I also hope you're able to find the books that have come out, even as book tours are being canceled, and that you're able to read and write. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Next week, I'll have a new interview with the author Ali Condi. Her publisher has released a 10-year anniversary edition of her young adult novel, Matched. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well, have a great week, and Happy New Year.